The virus is the economy. That is pretty obvious to the Chinese, anyway. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, again. This one's the 19th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will stipulate here that there are sharp differences between the American and Chinese economies and between the way the two countries have and are handling the pandemic. But more than 6 months after the virus brought China and its economy to a standstill, it is on its way back. Beijing reported today third quarter gross domestic product grew at a rate of 4.9%. Third quarters, July through September. That is thanks to exports and the country's consumers. But as Marketplace's Jennifer Pak reports now from Shanghai, it is not clear how much more Chinese consumers can do.
Retail sales bounced back for the first time this year in August and then rose again by 3.3% in September. But for Chinese consumers to keep spending more, they'll need help. China's official unemployment rate dropped to 5.4% from the usual 6. But some experts say this figure doesn't factor in millions of workers from the countryside who are jobless in the cities, and many more people went for months on half wages or with no pay at all. Unlike the U.S. government, China's Communist Party is not handing out cash to workers, so many dug into their savings to survive. The fourth quarter started off with a week-long holiday. People spent $70 billion on travel, 70% of what they spent last year. Still, there is a lot of excitement about China's recovery. It's on track to be the only major economy to grow this year. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
You're curious about U.S. economic growth, I know. We will get our first peek at our third quarter on October the 29th, subject, of course, to revisions. As virus case counts rise in much of the world, one of the big indicators of the health of the global economy is reacting. Oil is what I'm talking about here. Questions about supply and demand and price were on the agenda at an OPEC meeting today, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The world economy has been recovering in recent months, but now COVID cases are rising in places that happen to use a lot of oil, like India, Brazil, and the U.S. Herman Wang follows OPEC at S&P Global Platts.
Cases are surging, and a lot of governments are imposing lockdown measures again, reimposing those, and so that's going to have an impact on energy demand.
That's keeping prices down. The average pump price in the U.S. today is $2.15 a gallon and falling. Still, a next round of COVID might not crush gas use the way it did in the spring, says Jacques Rousseau at Clearview Energy Partners.
People feel safe in their cars, that they have that level under control in terms of the circle of people, you know, much more confident in driving in their cars versus getting on a plane or a train.
The bigger fear for oil producers is people don't want to fly. The group known as OPEC Plus, a bloc of exporters including Russia, is scheduled to loosen supply in January, but now it's not so sure. The Saudi energy minister, Prince Abdulaziz, says the group will do what it can to keep prices from falling. And consultant Sarah Vakshuri at SVB Energy says the minister's audience is not just traders, it's algorithms, big data programs that follow keywords and crank out price forecasts.
So Prince Abdulaziz is talking not only to me and you and traders in the market, he is also talking to a computer.
He wants them all to get the message that crude prices will be going up. OPEC's next full meeting is in 6 weeks. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, maybe they know nobody's coming to help. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While Congress and the White House do whatever it is they are doing about a new relief bill, we are learning more about how the last one played out, specifically about the Paycheck Protection Program. A new congressional report says the Treasury Department suggested banks favor their existing customers when considering applications for PPP loans, which meant that a lot of businesses, especially companies owned by women and minorities, were kind of out of luck. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
Back in April, J. Craig Gordon tried to apply through a bank for a PPP loan for the home health care company he runs in Savannah, Georgia.
It wasn't even a situation where we could even get an application in.
He didn't have a relationship with that bank. He tried applying through another bank, no luck there either. Gordon cut his own salary and put expansion plans on hold.
The next layer of cuts, unfortunately, was going to probably have to be some administrative layoffs. But thank goodness, you know, we weren't in a situation where we had to do that.
Hurdles like the one Gordon had to clear discouraged many Black business owners from applying for PPP loans, says Amanda Ballantyne, executive director of the small business advocacy group Main Street Alliance.
Black business owners were 50% more likely than white business owners to believe they wouldn't be approved, and were 3 times more likely than white business owners to be unaware that the program even existed.
A Main Street Alliance poll found that almost half of Black-owned small businesses have either shut down already or will soon. And even for those that manage to stay open, the pandemic recession is likely to do long-term damage, says Rashad Robinson, president of the racial justice nonprofit Color of Change.
They maybe lose connections with some of their customers, with the supply chain, maybe for materials or other things necessary to keep the business alive.
And that damage to businesses, Robinson says, makes Black communities more susceptible to gentrification. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Nobody needs more stress and anxiety right now for reasons that I would hope are obvious, but millions of Americans are facing more stress and anxiety, brought on literally by the roof over their heads, especially renters. According to our latest Marketplace Edison Research poll, 18% of renters in this economy have missed at least one payment in the past 6 months. That's compared to 14% of homeowners. Renters also tend to work in occupations that have been hit harder by shutdowns, like hospitality and retail, and they have fewer protections. And as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, that leaves a lot of people at risk of losing their housing during a public health crisis.
Charles White runs an ice cream truck business in Memphis, Tennessee, Boss Creams, spelled with a Z. And he says, compared to this time last year,
business sales have been down at least 50%.
Even in the heat of summer, he says, fear of the coronavirus kept a lot of customers away. He had to idle 2 of his 3 trucks and lay off 3 workers. His wife just had hip surgery and can't work. And now that the weather's getting cooler,
I think I'm going to have to pitch me a second job, but I can't do nothing until my wife is, you know, able to get up and walk around.
White is one of the nearly 20% of people in our poll who said they'd missed a rent payment in the past 6 months. 64%, nearly 2/3, fear they'll miss one in the future. White is 3 months behind. His landlord is an old friend, so he's been patient. Anthony Pino's landlord has not.
He's even been charging me late fees. He raised my rent during all this.
Pino runs a tile business in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which had to shut down for a few months when the state put a halt to most construction. He's been back at work since June, but says business is still half what it should be this time of year. Now 2 months behind on rent, Pino says he may have to find another place to live.
Well, me and my landlord are going to go to court because I know he can't evict me right now with this pandemic going on, but I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't.
Right now, a national moratorium on evictions from the CDC protects renters from being removed from their homes if they can't pay. But Emily Benfer, a law professor at Wake Forest University, says the Trump administration is allowing property owners to start the eviction process by filing with the court.
And in doing this, they thwarted the purpose of the order itself to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
She says many renters will do anything to avoid the eviction system. So the moment they receive a notice, they leave.
And that's what starts the crowded living environments. That's what starts the increased contact with others and that inability to social distance.
In the 17 cities tracked by the Eviction Lab, landlords have filed for more than 60,000 evictions during the pandemic. And Benfer says when the CDC moratorium expires at the end of December,
we can expect that evictions will increase to unseen heights.
Even when the rent does get paid, often something else doesn't. Back in June, we talked to Juliana Sandridge from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, outside Tulsa. She'd lost her job and was facing eviction while she waited for unemployment benefits to come through. They finally did, but in order to catch up on her rent, she missed utility bills.
My water was shut off for about 2.5, 3 weeks, maybe. My electric's been shut off probably 3 or 4 times for a few days at a time.
Sandridge has 4 kids still at home and a 15-month-old granddaughter. she still hasn't found a new job.
I've gained weight from just stress. I've broke out. I can't sleep. You know, it's not so much I'm worried about myself because I could get by, but you know, you don't want that for your children.
She's counting on Congress to make a deal for more relief. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think once it starts producing some money and jobs, then people will start talking about it.
Yeah, that sounds about right, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Ooh, I'm not sure I was expecting the Wawas today. What do you know? Dow Industrial's down 410 points, 1.4%, closed at 28,195. The NASDAQ down 192, 1.6%, finished at 11,478. The S&P 500 down 56 points, 1.6%, 34.26. Tech companies led the decline. Apple dipped 2.5%. Microsoft and Google's parent company, Alphabet, both shaved off 2.4%. Maybe I'm just getting jaundiced by all this stuff. Not expecting the Wawas. Anyway, as coronavirus cases rise, Target says it's going to hand out a fresh round of employee bonuses heading into the holiday season. More than 350,000 workers will collect $200. Target, of course, has seen big gains. Target shares, though, lost 0.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The flu is coming. The coronavirus is here and cases are rising in most places, which in that way the economy works could mean a healthcare labor shortage. So CVS, the pharmacy chain, says it's going to add 15,000 pharmacy workers this winter. Most of them are going to be technicians to help with virus testing and flu shots and maybe eventually a COVID vaccine, because local drugstores are going to be on the pointy end of the logistical chain of getting hundreds of millions of vaccine doses out. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that story.
One of the trends in healthcare over recent years has been the rise of retail clinics, you know, the kind you find in CVS and Walgreens. Dr. Ativ Mehrotra, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard, says these clinics have some big advantages.
They've got good hours. You don't have to make an appointment. Parking is easy. While you're waiting, you can do some extra shopping.
He's found these clinics serve patients who might not otherwise go to traditional doctor's offices, helping to boost flu vaccination rates. Drug makers are preparing a record number of flu shots this year, and demand for an eventual COVID vaccine could put unprecedented strain on healthcare systems. That's where retail clinics could be a big help, says Robert Field, a professor of health management at Drexel University.
The idea is to do low-end services that are easy, that don't involve a lot of technology and a lot of highly skilled staff.
Pharmacy technician positions require a high school diploma, a short certification program, and clearance from the government to give vaccines. The jobs pay about $15 an hour. A big vaccine surge could drive traffic to pharmacy storefronts, which have seen sales slow during the pandemic, says Matthew Hamery, a retail consultant with Alex Partners.
You might go in, let's say, get a flu shot, pick up, you know, some healthcare and beauty products, pick up a prescription.
Though if pharmacies are hoping for a shot in the arm from vaccines, the benefit could be limited. Many retail clinics are holding immunizations outside. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Here's something you ought to do tomorrow morning. Listen to the Marketplace Morning Report. David Brancaccio and the gang that gets out of bed real early to get you ready for your economic day. Here is your periodic reminder that we are still in a trade war. China, of course, the European Union, Canada as well, lots of tariffs. The Trump administration will tell you it's trying to get more companies to make stuff here. Marta Miller has been doing that since well before the Trump administration. She is the co-founder and CEO of Lefty Production Company. It's based here in Los Angeles. and it helps fashion brands and designers turn their ideas into sellable clothes. Yes, an American manufacturing company, but one that, like so many others, has had to adjust this year. Ms. Miller, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So there you are in February, March of this year doing your thing, and then the pandemic starts rolling across the globe. What does that do to Lefty Production Company?
It was the craziest time, honestly. It was, I mean, every time I opened my computer, it was like, let's put a halt on that. You know, can I get my deposit back? Mm. We don't want this stuff anymore. So also, we ultimately sew and manufacture, and social distancing is pretty tough. And so while all these orders were kind of canceling, I remember watching the news and New York was saying, we need masks, we need masks. Mm. And my husband and I started getting on the phone and trying to figure out, like, all right, we can sew. Like, you know, so we started just beginning to create some masks.
The thing is, though, you're making stuff in L.A., but you now have relocated your family to Texas. So you're running this company remotely.
Completely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
talk to me about the CEO challenges there, boss.
It's funny. I'm a mom of two, and I would say my 2019 largest conversation that my husband and I had was, how do we get me out of the day-to-day? Mm-hmm. I think every single member of my team would tell you that the company runs so much better with me a little distance from it. It's just been the biggest COVID silver lining.
So let me ask you to pull back for a minute, right? Because you're down in the weeds of American manufacturing. And I'd love your perspective, I guess, on how you see this having changed or changing American manufacturing, because, you know, you're a good example, right? You pivoted and now you're doing this thing and you've moved and the company is still thriving.
You know, we've been seeing this need for American manufacturing to come back for a while now, mainly because retail has changed. And, you know, it's easier to go overseas when you're producing 5-10,000 units of something. When you want to make 500 units of something, being overseas just doesn't really make sense anymore with the tariffs and it just stops, the dollars stop working for you. When we have Barney's going bankrupt, when we have these big stores not placing as large a volume and as large of inventory, then all of a sudden the brands don't need to place that amount of inventory with their factory anymore. And what we're really seeing with COVID is this emergence of smaller, more unique brands and the amazing part of social media where, you know, people love to buy a jogger from the girl that's tie-dyeing it out of her garage.
So are you seeing that? I mean, instead of getting the 50 or 500,000, yeah. So you're seeing the $5,000 order from this woman who wants to make a jogger or who wants to make shorts or whatever?
And it's not a $5,000 order. I mean, I have some clients, you know, they might have 500,000-700,000 followers, but it's not like they just have followers. They have an engaged following.
Yeah.
Those people want to respond to inventory. They want to say, hey guys, vote. Do you want blue or pink? You know, and now everybody likes the blue. We want to go ahead and make 1,000. And so this need to not have so much inventory, yeah, I think is really going to drive American manufacturing.
All right. So last thing, and then I'll let you get off the phone. How much of this do you think is permanent? Because obviously the economy is changing. We don't know what it's going to be like in 6 months or a year. What's your guess?
I have to say, I was a little disheartened by the hospitals, to be completely honest. You know, at the beginning, a lot of the hospitals were like, oh my gosh, like, why haven't we been doing American manufacturing? It's so nice being able to develop something in our backyard. And the second China came back online, that story has changed a little bit. So yeah. Do I feel like, okay, all of a sudden we're going to be making millions and millions of masks and gowns in America anymore? I don't know that that's staying, but I do feel like fashion and clothing is definitely going to start making a big comeback to America.
Marta Miller. She's the CEO and co-founder of Lefty Production Company. Marta, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
You want to have a green economy, you're going to need certain things. Among them, a whole lot of lithium. It's a key component in batteries for the electric cars we're all eventually going to be driving and for storing the on-again, off-again energy that wind and solar generate. Problem is, lithium is in relatively short supply, which is why a discovery of it in Cornwall in southwest Britain, centuries ago, it was a key mining region. Now it has them hoping for a new boom. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
At the King Edward Mine Museum in Camborne, a blast from Cornwall's prosperous past. Machines like this once pounded lumps of local granite, extracting the tin that turned this county into one of the richest mining regions in the world. By the 1800s, one-third of the world's copper came from Cornwall. But while the ancient working machines on display at the museum conjure up a distant past, a few miles away, a vision of Cornwall's future is unfolding.
Lithium is the lightest metal. It's soft enough to be cut with scissors. So light it floats on water.
The company that made this video, Cornish Lithium, says it's discovered what it calls a globally significant grade of the metal in underground water pumped up to the surface here. The 21st century equivalent of striking oil. The company's founder is Jeremy Rothel.
Without lithium, there is no real transition to electric vehicles and to a renewable energy. So it is the most important element out there at the moment. It's exciting times for us.
Doubly exciting, he says, because his company could be riding to Europe's rescue.
It is vitally important that particularly Europe gets their own source of supply of lithium, because currently Europe produces absolutely no lithium for batteries whatsoever.
Most of the world's supply is currently extracted in Chile, Argentina and Australia, and processed in China.
So we are very strategically vulnerable.
The additional beauty of the lithium that his company's discovered, says his senior geologist, Lucy Crane, is the temperature of the underground water or brine that's carrying the metal.
It's hot, so the geothermal gradient that you have down here is a lot warmer than in other parts of the country, which means we've got a lot more potential for geothermal energy in Cornwall.
The prospect is environmentally enticing. Extract the lithium and use the hot brine to power, carbon-free, the plant and perhaps a battery factory too. The prospect is economically enticing as well.
It could potentially bring jobs. It could potentially bring wealth to the area.
Deborah Reeve, mayor of the nearby town of Redruth. She hopes that lithium will reverse the long, steep decline the town has suffered since tin mining came to an end in the last century.
There are pockets of deprivation now, aren't there, in this town, in this county?
Yes, absolutely. Cornwall is one of the poorest parts of Europe.
And the good times still seem a long way off, judging by the modest purchases at this greengrocer's store in Redruth.
That's 5.23, please.
There's no buzz here about the potential treasures on the doorstep. The shop's owner, Lee Collins, told me he's not heard any of his customers even mention the prospect of a lithium bonanza.
I think it's because every so often you hear a little bit, oh, we're going to start mining for X, Y, or Z, and nothing really comes of it. So
the town is not in the grip of lithium fever?
No. But like I say, I think once it starts producing some money and jobs, then people will start talking about it.
Cornish Lithium reckons it could start production within 3 to 5 years. It won't say how much of the metal it thinks it can mine, but Cornwall is sitting on more than 70 miles of granite, one of the largest such blocks on the planet. And it turns out, the hottest of hot rocks in the 21st century. In Redruth, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a milestone of sorts in commercial aviation in this country. You all know I love the TSA throughput count, right? How many passengers were screened yesterday versus a year ago? Well, yesterday, for the first time since the 16th of March, more than a million people went through checkpoints in airports in this country. 1.03 million, to be just a bit more exact. Nice, but still down 40% from a year ago. Okay, we're going, but not without your Monday moment of economic context. It's a tad counterintuitive, this one, but it is good news. We learned this morning from the Fair Isaac Corporation that the average credit score in this economy hit a record high in July. Now, how can that be, you ask, in the middle of a crushing pandemic-induced recession? Well, government assistance, of course, deferment programs for mortgages and consumer loans, too, and people just paying down their credit card debt as well. Our daily production team is Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.